Welcome to the morning instructions. Over the days, we've been practicing mindfulness in many of its different ways or forms. We've been giving attention and mindfulness to the body, to the breath, to the feeling world. And then yesterday, we paid particular attention to mindfulness of the mind states, or mindfulness of the mental formations, that which is going on in the mind. And today we come to the fourth foundation of mindfulness, which is called mindfulness of the Dharma. The Dharma means all teachings of awakening. All teachings that wake us up. And in this case, in particular, of course, it means the teachings of the Buddha. So we can use our mindfulness practice to contemplate certain aspects of the Dharma teachings, particular teachings. And we can use our sitting as a way of contemplating or reflecting on one of the teachings, taking them, perhaps we take the teaching, as we will later today, of impermanence, and we sit and we reflect and contemplate on the depth of meaning of that and of our own understanding of it. Some of you over the days may have become slightly confused by the whole variety of instructions on offer. If you wish, it is perfectly fine for the entire retreat just to stay with mindfulness of breathing. But I hope by showing you the totality of the teachings, or laying out the fullness of the four foundations, that you will get an overall picture or view or understanding, and that some of the things that are said will perhaps resonate rather deeply. Some people like to take these 16 couplets of the Anapanasati Sutta in order and spend weeks and weeks and weeks on one and then move to the next. move to the next. This linear approach is completely and absolutely fine, and there's a lot of teachers who teach in this way. There is, however, another approach, and it is to lay out the Dharma. And of course it can be that this can be your very first retreat, and you hear something that is a rather perhaps sophisticated instruction, and yet it makes perfect sense to you. So it can be that you're here for the first time and you understand something that is profound and deep. It can be that you've meditated for many, many retreats and you've never heard something put in a particular way. And just the phrasing of the sentence or something about the conditions at the time means that an insight arises. It lands. We understand it. People often come to me and they say, "Radha, why didn't you say that before? Then I would have understood." And I say, "But this is what I have been saying. I've been saying it over and over." And so sometimes we just hear in a particular way, there's something that is said by one of the teachers or by somebody else in one of the inquiries that touches us rather deeply, and insight and understanding emerges. This is the way of the Dharma. This is the Dharma path. So there can be gradual understanding, and there can also be sudden understandings, and there can be a combination of the two. We can have some profound and deep experiences which are life-changing, and then that experience needs to be comprehended, it needs to be fully understood, we need to reflect on it and tease out the deep and profound understanding. After the Buddha was sitting for his wonderful liberating night under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya 2600 years ago, he spent 7 weeks reflecting on that night. So we have an experience, and then our task is also not just to say, oh well, I had that, it's done, it's finished, but to see into the experience, to tease out the understanding, to see what the experience actually means for my life. What does it mean for how I live my life when I have an experience of connectedness with all beings, for example? So this is the way we need to reflect and contemplate and think about the Dhamma. So there's great encouragement to inquire and to really see into our experience and take it really, really deeply. So now I want to come to the specific directions or instructions for today. The first is, I shall breathe in, contemplating impermanence. I shall breathe out, contemplating impermanence. Most of you will have heard the word impermanence. All that arises ceases, ends. This moment is shifting, changing, impermanent. This body is shifting, changing, impermanent. And the impermanence and the shiftings and the changes seem to speed up as one gets older. And there's extraordinary changes that begin to happen in the body. So we see very clearly that all things, including this body, are impermanent. We see our very life is impermanent. Everybody who is born dies. This is a truth of the Dhamma. This is fundamental. It is one thing to see that and know it intellectually and to say, oh yes, of course I understand that. It is perfectly obvious. It is another to reflect on it and see what that means rather deeply for us in our daily life, from moment to moment, to see what impermanence means in our relationships to those we love, to see what it means in terms of our relationship with ourselves. So it's something to be deeply reflected upon. The next, I shall breathe in, contemplating fading away. I shall breathe out, contemplating fading away. Now, this kind of fading away isn't a disappearance into non-existence. That's not what's meant. It is, the Pali word means a dispassion. So it means the fading away of all that hinders us from knowing our freedom. So it's the fading away of our greed. It's the fading away of our negativity. It's the fading away of our problems. It's the fading away of our confusion. It's the fading away of all that which appears to be in the way of our rather natural liberation, to be in the way of freedom. We perceive that there are certain obstacles to our freedom. It's very natural to look at it this way. And the fading away comes when we loosen our grip on the idea of the self. The fading away comes when we give up being compelled by our desires, when we give up rushing along in pursuit of certain things, when we stop and look and see what we are doing. The fading away comes when we start to see clearly. So this is what is meant by fading away. The fading away of all the hindrances, the fading away of our restlessness, the fading away of our doubt, the fading away of our anger. So sometimes in our practice, we think, oh, I'm waiting for some kind of enlightened experience, and it hasn't come. Where is it? All these teachers are talking about this, and nothing is happening to me. So we might look at it like that. So we need to see that there are perceived barriers, actually not real. So our restlessness, our agitation, comes and goes. It's impermanent. Sometimes we're restless, sometimes we're not. Sometimes we're caught up in self, and sometimes we're not. But as we go along, it generally happens that with practice, that we become more and more and more free in our daily life. We don't quite realize it, and there's been no big bang experience, no lightning bolt from above where our lives changed automatically and forever. This can happen. But there's a gradual freeing up of our lives. And we can look back and say, oh, I used to be rather angry with all of my friends and my family, and now anger rarely arises. This is the fading away of our anger, and so on. So when we look, sometimes we can see the gradual fading away of that which hinders us in life. The fading away of the barriers. When the Buddha was asked what his mind state was like, what it was like for him, he said that he lived with a mind rid of barriers. A mind and heart unobstructed, unhindered. So this is our goal. The third couplet. I breathe in, contemplating cessation. Cessation means the ending of something. When something ceases, it finishes, it ends. I breathe out, contemplating cessation. So, it's easy if we start with really simple things. This is a rather sophisticated practice or instruction, but I think it's a really precious one, because all too often we don't notice the endings of things. We notice when a problem arises, but we forget to notice when it ends, when it's finished, when it's no longer problematic. So we start with the simple things, the cessation of each breath, the cessation or ending of each moment. And then as we continue, we start to see the cessation of a feeling, or the cessation of a problematic emotion. So we start to notice, oh, there's the ending. And then we start to see the very natural ending of any condition. And when we see this, we realize the wisdom of cessation. Conditions arise and cease. So, for example, we're on a train in India, and we have a very long train journey. It can be very uncomfortable. But the condition arises and it ceases. When we have a view about something or an idea, the condition arises and it ceases. And the more we start to be with our inner life, mindfully, with attention, really wakeful attention, the more we start just to trust that process, we see this natural ending of many things in a day. And the natural ending is a really wonderful point to be attentive. Because with the ending of the painful, there's the ending of the problematic. So for example, we see the ending, we have a desire for something. We see the ending of it. Desire comes, passes. Of course, it's impermanent like everything else. So that we see the arising of the desire, it stays for a moment and then it passes. The I has no claim over it. So with this practice, we're not trying to make things go away. We're not trying to make things end, but we're just seeing the very natural ending that occurs, that everything that arises ends, and we're just paying attention right there. There are, of course, in the Dharma teachings, practices of, you know, meditations on death. This is a attention to an ending. The ending of life. In Thailand, people actually go to the morgue and reflect on death. Part of the monk's training is reflection, and seeing the body, the dead body, and reflecting on that and all it means for this body, my body, this life. And these practices are some of us might be initially horrified at them, but actually they can be rather profound. In India, for example, some of you may have been to Varanasi, where the bodies are burned by the river. And I remember as a young woman, I sat all night watching a body burn. And it was the first time I had ever seen such a thing. And it touched me deeply to see the ending, the dissolution, the turning of the body into ash. For this is the nature of our body too. So when we start to look in this way and pay attention, profound insights and wisdom can arise. And then, of course, with cessation, we start to see the ending, hopefully, the ending of our clinging to the idea of self. We see the ending of our desires, and we also see the ending of our problems. And then beauty, aliveness, wisdom, and truth shine forth. So this is the wonder, really, of the practice of cessation. And finally, I shall breathe in, contemplating relinquishment. I shall breathe out, contemplating relinquishment. Relinquishment means letting go. And put really simply, the Dharma teaches us to cling to no thing, that nothing is worth clinging to. So our practice of relinquishment or of letting go is fundamental to our practice. And some of you say, oh, but how? I know I have to let go, but how? So remember the instructions on the first or second day, where if we're clinging on to something, here I have my glasses in my hand, clinging on. If we hold tightly and grip, we can't let go. However, if we just open, glasses are still there. But there's an openness. It's unproblematic. So openness is one of the factors that really helps us let go. Softening the grip of our clinging. Seeing the wisdom of letting go is something else that helps us let go. We know that if we cling, we suffer. We know that if we let go, we're released to peace, to freedom. So when we start to see that in ourselves, we learn to let go. Because we know the letting go is the end of suffering. The letting go is our freedom. The letting go reveals the freedom and the peace. We can't make ourselves let go. If we say, I must let go, we just set up resistance. It's a process of loosening, of softening, of seeing our particular views, for example. We cling to views. We think, I'm right, I know best. My way is the best way. And certainly in the world of politics, there's a real strength of view that can come through when we cling to a position and we don't want to change it. Because we think we're right. Of course, the other person's wrong. So we also have to learn in those areas to soften the view. To soften the views we hold about others, and to soften the views we hold about ourselves. This is wisdom. So let's do the first of the contemplations. The first of the contemplations of the Dharma is contemplating impermanence. So if you would please, as we've been doing over the days, just for 2 or 3 minutes, I breathe in, contemplating impermanence. I breathe out, contemplating impermanence. So what did you discover about impermanence? Anybody have any reflections? Yes. Yes, please.
You said that it's sad because you lose the meaning. I felt kind of sadness.
Ah.
Because you lose the meaning.
Okay. Okay, say a little more. So you felt sad that you lose the meaning of what? Ah, okay. So you had the sense that because things are impermanent, something is lost. Ah. Is that necessarily the case, do you think? I mean, certainly, when somebody dies, something is lost. What other situations? Did any particular situation come to mind? Nothing special. Yeah. So I think that as human beings, we cannot live without loss. Loss is one of the conditions of this life. No one has ever lived who hasn't lost something or somebody. And I think that it's one of the difficult and painful things about life. What happens when you are with that sadness? If you just allow that sadness to be in your heart, what happens then?
Feel.
Yes, you feel? And then?
Feel, I'm afraid.
Oh, fear. Okay, and what's the fear of?
The indifference of life.
Of change?
No, the change makes things indifferent, you don't care.
Indifferent.
Ah, all right. So, indifference separates us from life, doesn't it? Indifference could be slightly cold, couldn't it? Equanimity to life, or steadiness in the face of loss, doesn't actually mean indifference. You see, because things end, it doesn't mean that we don't feel warm or loving or alive. If we think something is ending, so therefore I'll protect myself by not caring, then it becomes problematic. Because if we live a life where we don't care, or we withdraw, or we shut down, then it's an unhappy life. Because it's alienated, we're alone. So, we need to find a way of being with the sadness that isn't one of withdrawal, or isn't one of distancing, or isn't one of disassociation. And it's very important that we discover how to be not only with our joy, but how to be with our sorrow as well. And we need to embrace with the heart our sorrow, our sadness. And I think it's a very important point that you make, that we need to find a way of being with that aspect of life, of loss, where we don't shut down, where we don't close our heart, where we don't withdraw into coldness and distance. Because we as human beings, we love to feel connected, but we love to feel intimate with life and not just push life away. The pushing of life away leads only to unhappiness. I'm a psychologist, I hear it all the time. The shutting down to protect oneself from the loss of life leads to enormous suffering. And so the wisdom aspect of the practice is to find a way of being with the impermanent nature, to find a way of being with the loss, being with our sadness and sorrow, that is vital, alive, freeing. And it's not easy. Anyone else? Yes.
My experience is daily experience. I mean, not only these 3 minutes of meditation, just the opposite. Maybe because of my age and the experiences of so many changes. Every moment is so precious because I know that it can tomorrow. It can fade away, and
yes.
Really, I try to you know make the best to,
yes.
To open my heart to any moment of experience because this is what I experience, and maybe tomorrow I won't be here.
Yes. Yes. That's why the Buddha keeps saying, "Meditate now. We never know when death will come." Did you hear me? So tomorrow morning, please all come to the sitting. Thank you. There was someone over here. Yes.
I also felt at ease, mainly because I reflected about faces and things I went through that ended.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Without pushing for it, without forcing it, it just happens naturally. It's okay just to let go and be with things and it will pass.
So in some ways, reflections on impermanence can be comforting because we know it's the natural order of things, the natural process of things. And so we can just be with it. Okay, we're going to do one more. At least one more. Let's do the final one, which is I shall breathe in contemplating relinquishment. I shall breathe out contemplating relinquishment. So now you've all let go of everything, as instructed, I hope. So, anybody, what did you discover when you began to contemplate or reflect upon, or hopefully to actually experience relinquishment? What occurred? Yes, at the back? Yes?
I was surprised when you showed what you did with your glasses.
Yes?
Because I had an idea that letting go means letting go.
Throwing them away.
Yes, and I was afraid you were going to let your glasses fall or something on the floor. And it was surprising for me to see that your glasses were still there.
Mm.
So then I understood, I had a new understanding. Changing the grip.
Yes. 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 And yes again. Exactly. And when we loosen the grip we have on life, we're still with life. There's still the events of life. But our relationship to them is different. There's an openness, a receptivity. And that's the ground for love and freedom, joy. Beautiful. Well seen. Anybody else? On this theme of relinquishment, letting go.
It's more a question of technique. Do you mean by that I should repeat this to myself throughout the meditation if I sit for an hour? So
no, I don't. I don't mean by giving these instructions that you sit there saying over and over the words, but rather you make a decision to contemplate or take up one of these practices. And so in this case, it's I contemplate relinquishment. So I shall breathe in, contemplating relinquishment. I shall breathe out, contemplating relinquishment. So then we sit down and we just do it. So as we're breathing in and out, we reflect on the teaching of non-clinging. We don't say over and over and over the words like a mantra.
But do I choose an object to relinquish?
No, this is a
relationship.
Yeah.
Do I
this
choose?
Is a reflection on the teaching. And what will probably occur as you start to reflect is that an issue will come to mind in your life. Something will be there in your face, right there. And then you can contemplate the letting go, the relinquishment. What's required in order for me to let go? What do I need to do to let go of this situation? And so on.
With the solution also, I should contemplate the solution as well.
It's not just a solution-focused way of contemplation, but contemplation is not just thinking about. When we contemplate something, we place the question or the intention in our heart, and we sit there and then we wait for the unfolding experience to occur. So it's not that we say, okay, I must let go of this, but rather we reflect, we contemplate, we just heard an understanding of the contemplation. So things will occur to you, things will come, insights will come. wisdom will come in relationship to the whole idea or notion of relinquishment and what that means to you in your life. And I often say, as part of my therapy practice to people, when they tell me their painful histories, one of my questions is, what would you like to let go of? And often people say, everything. Everything. And so we have to see and we have to start. Oh, can I let go of my anger? Can I let go of my righteousness? Can I let go of somebody I love? And so on. Anybody else? One more.
Hi.
Yes?
It's a process of a year, a few months, perhaps, of shifting from clinging to the negative to seeing the positive. And as you know, I feel really unwell physically right
yes.
now. And I'm clinging to, I have this tendency to cling to this feeling not well, and the sense of an urgency. But I have these moments of seeing that it's much more useful to let go of the negative view.
Yes.
To rise upon the yielding, the feeling of being ill.
Yes.
And what happened now is that I really fully saw my the freedom of really leaving the fear and negativity and letting healing and life and light being present in the heart. And it suddenly affected the body.
Yes. Beautiful. So when we are ill, it can be rather difficult not to add another layer of negativity to the original problem, which is the illness. And our way of being with ourselves when we're ill needs to be quite fine. Fine and tender and compassionate and light. And then our attention turns from the notion I am ill and my life's a mess and therefore I need all of these things immediately, or someone to help me, or my life to change, to the seeing of a way of being with the body, even if the body is not well. A way of being content or happy in the face of discomfort. And this is a really precious thing to discover, because we will always, all of us, experience pain and discomfort in life. And freedom and liberation is not freedom from discomfort. Sorry. It's a way of being with the painful and the pleasant, being with sickness and health, with steadiness, with clarity, with love, with vision, with the freedom of heart and mind. And if you've discovered that, it's precious and life-changing. Thank you, each of you, for listening.